This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Welcome. Glad you decided to listen in today. If you're a new listener, this is where we talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for you and your money. If you're a regular listener, welcome back. Glad you decided to tune in once again. I've got a couple great guests joining me on today's program. Mr. Jeffrey Frankel, who is the James W. Harpell Professor of Capital Formation and Growth at the Harvard Kennedy School, will join me. We will debate Obamacare and current economic policy. We love to have an open exchange of ideas here on the program. And joining me on the second part of today's program, David Scranton. David is the Amazon best-selling author of a terrific book that we're going to chat with him about. The name of the book is Return on Principle, and he'll be joining me, as I said, on the second part of today's program. Reminder that we do have some free educational resources regarding how to collect your Social Security benefits coming up during the month of October. On Thursday, October 13, we'll be at the Highlands Golf Club. That's in Grand Rapids on Leonard Street Northwest. And on Tuesday, October 18, we'll be out at Nodo's Old World Italian Restaurant. That's on 28th Street in Grand Rapids. Both of these Social Security maximization workshops begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. If you'd like to get more information or you'd like to register while capacity remains, just visit the website socialsecurityradio.com. The website, again, is socialsecurityradio.com. I am pleased to have as a returning guest on the program, Jeffrey A. Frankel. He is the James W. Harpell Professor of Capital Formation and Growth at the Harvard Kennedy School. And Jeff, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Jeff, you know, we were chatting a bit before we started to record our conversation about some political phenomenon that we're seeing really around the world. We had the Brexit vote not long ago in which the UK voted to leave the EU, and now we've got this rise of what might have at one point been fringe political candidates. We saw Bernie Sanders do really well, and now Donald Trump, you know, there's a reasonable chance he could actually win the election, depending on who you listen to and what day it is. To what do you attribute all this?
Well, I'm not sure. All those trends that you mentioned certainly came as a surprise to the pundits and to me and just about everyone I know. The usual interpretation is that this is somehow related to our failure to adequately appreciate the issue of inequality, that not everyone is sharing in the gains. Most of the gains are going to the upper 1%, and that the working class has sort of been left out, and certainly the poor have been left out, which is, you know, I mean, it's true that these measures of inequality, at least up until last year, did show that as a clear trend since the turn of the century. The popular interpretation is that people are blaming this on globalization, and so they're turning against globalization, and that's why they voted for Brexit, and that's why they're supporting why many Democrats on the left supported Sanders and why Trump is getting so much support. I mean, I personally find that interpretation a little surprising. It may be correct as a political analysis, but to my mind, it's rather puzzling.
So, Jeff, when you look at this inequality, which certainly, as I think you confirmed, that this wealth gap has been increasing. The rich are getting richer, and it's getting tougher for those in the middle class and the lower economic classes to be able to just meet their everyday needs. To what extent has Fed policy contributed to this, and to what extent might people just be ticked off? I mean, my take is that you see these political candidates that may not have been viable candidates a couple election cycles ago, and you see the Brexit vote, and I attribute it to the fact that these central bank policies around the world have maybe led to this wealth gap, and people are just ticked off. To what extent would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I don't think central bank policies actually have much to do with it. I mean, you can think, and I know some people are saying, because Actually, they say it both ways. I'm not even sure whether, you know, low interest rates. People who complain about the Fed policy, some of them want interest rates, monetary policy even easier, and some of them want it tighter. You know, one view is if you're retired and living off your savings, that the interest rates are so low that you're worse off, or that and it's true that easy money has helped push up stock prices, and stocks are mainly held by the wealthy. So those things are true. But the usual interpretation, which I think is right, is that on net it goes the other way. People who are debtors who have borrowed, they tend to have lower incomes than people who are creditors who have lent. And certainly, I mean, here's the main point. The recent statistics, I think, have confirmed again that the best thing you can do for the incomes of the working class is have an economy that's operating at high levels of employment. Because when unemployment is high, as it was after the financial crisis, the people who get hit by that are lower-income workers. And it's really only in, we've seen job creation at a kind of a record trend over the last 5 years. I'm not sure everyone realizes that. The job situation, given where we were coming from, looks pretty good. A record number of consecutive months of positive job creation, a record number of private sector jobs created, 15 million. And now, finally, it's also showing up into higher real wages. And I think that's one of the reasons why last year, for the first time in a very long time, actually the first time ever in terms of the magnitude, real median family income went up by 5%, and the poverty rate went down. It's really a high-pressure, highly employed economy that's good not just for total growth, as long as you don't overdo it, but also good for income distribution. And the Fed has been one part of that. So that's not where I would look for the explanation for inequality.
So, Jeffrey, it's true that we've seen those real gains over the last year, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the 5 years prior to that, we saw median household incomes actually declined by about 10% over a five-year time frame. So why the turnaround?
Well, what you're talking about is a huge decline that happened in the global recession from December 2007 to June 2009. That was such a big loss that it's true that even with this big increase in median family income last year, we're just almost back to where we were before the recession. But the real point is longer term. The real point is that, in some sense, for 40 years, but especially since the turn of the century, the income of the typical American worker has stagnated. Well, I think not increased at all if you measure it relative to 2000. It's not just that we haven't climbed above in the year before the Great Recession, 2007. We also haven't climbed above 2000 because there wasn't any net growth during the Bush years, if I can phrase it that way, the years 2001 to 2007 or 8, even before the recession kicked in. And to some extent, it goes back to the 70s, that the kind of gains that the middle class experience and the people in poverty, low-income people, the gains that were experienced across the board in the 1960s really have not been with us on average for 40 years.
So let me play devil's advocate as to the entire central banking system, and I think I know where you're going to come down on this, but it might be fun to ask you anyway if you'll just humor me. I've had a number of guests here on the program that have said that the reason that we haven't seen the gains that you mentioned since the 70s is because in 1971 the gold window was closed and we're not using honest money. What would your response be?
Well, so I think when Richard Nixon was the one who shut the gold window in 1971 and did a lot of other things at the same time, put up these, you know, big trade barriers devalued the dollar in 71 and 73, and put on wage price controls. I mean, it's an amazing thing that a supposedly conservative Republican is the one president who has put on wage price controls, which are very extensive interference in the, you know, market system. I mean, nobody's Democrat or Republican since then has even proposed doing that. So I think, you know, and and it was followed excessively expansionary fiscal and monetary policy at the same time to, in order to fight the war in Vietnam, basically. So I give it a little marks to that. I mean, probably the gold standard, the version of it that we had from 1944 to 1971 was bound to come apart eventually anyway, because it's just so difficult. And you look at attempts to countries that have currency boards or attempts to rigidly repeg their currencies, or what the member countries of the euro have been going through lately. It's just really hard to keep that together. So probably it would have come undone eventually anyway. But I think the excessive money and monetary and fiscal growth of not just Nixon, but Lyndon Johnson as well, did help undo that. Was that the cause of, was that the big, was that the serpent in the Garden of Eden? Is that the reason why everything has looked worse economically since the mid-70s than it did before? I don't think so. I mean, the immediate thing that happened, if you remember, was the big oil shock. The price of oil quadrupled in 1974, and at least at the time, and for years afterwards, that seemed to be the cause. But since then, there's been a lot of water under the bridge. We've seen a lot of ups and downs in oil prices. We've seen a lot of ups and downs in the economy, and yet we have this long-term slower rate of growth. But I think one has to look elsewhere than monetary policy. And in fact, I think monetary policy overall has been better since the 70s than it was before.
Well, we are chatting today with Jeffrey A. Frankel. He is the James W. Harpell Professor of Capital Formation and Growth at the Harvard Kennedy School. And we'll continue our conversation with him when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program, brought to you by PLP Services. In this segment, I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Jeff Frankel, and we'll have a debate about the effectiveness of certain fiscal and social policies. I am pleased to be chatting today with Jeffrey A. Frankel. He is the James W. Harpell Professor of Capital Formation and Growth at the Harvard Kennedy School. And we have limited time in this segment, Jeff, so let me jump in. We would probably be remiss if we didn't talk a little politics. As far as the upcoming election is concerned, it looks a lot different than past elections. Can you put your finger on it?
Well, in some ways it does, in some ways it doesn't. Certainly to have a woman for the Democratic candidate for the first time, and the former spouse, and someone like Donald Trump as a Republican candidate who is, zero experience in government, zero experience in the military. Nothing like that has remotely happened before, or things he says, like whether you like him or not, are just come way outside the box of what had been considered normal. So in many, many respects, it's not a normal year. But in one respect, I think it is. The two candidates, if you ask what policies they stand for, and it's easier to say in the case of Hillary, because she's got all this stuff in writing and all these advisors and all this, whereas Trump is, people sort of like his spontaneity, I guess, but he's all over the map. He's, says one thing and then the next day says the opposite. But you can sort of get a broad view as to where the two of them are. And so let me try to say something about how this relates to this issue of inequality. There are plenty of people who say the problem is that there's too much money in politics, and I think there is. I mean, there was this Citizens United case where the Supreme Court ruled that corporations would be treated as citizens in the sense of having free speech, that just opened the floodgates for money pouring into political campaigns. And so some people feel that because of that, and because the rich have more money than the rest of us, that's the fundamental flaw in the system. Well, one thing I would note is that money's not going into the pockets of corrupt politicians. If you listen to complaints, you would think that, and that's true in some countries. But in the U.S., it doesn't, for the most part, go into the politicians' pockets. It goes into their political campaigns. It goes to get out the vote and for TV advertising. So I wonder about those people who say, I'm so alienated with the system, I think the votes of people like me don't count, so I'm not going to register, or if I do register, I'm not going to go to the polls, or if I do go to the polls, I'm going to vote for one of the third-party candidates, which to my mind is just throwing your vote away completely, since it's not going to affect the outcome. And it's interesting, because you know, the logic they often give is they think that money corrupts everything, and so votes like them, of people like them, don't matter. But their votes are going to determine the election. If those people go to the polls and vote, that will determine the outcome. If you stay at home because you don't like the idea there's money in politics, it's the same thing. It has the exact same effect as some fat cat who gives money to the candidate who's the opposite of the one you would have voted for. And, you know, globalization might, trade and immigration, it might be a contributor to inequality. Certainly technology is, and education not keeping up with technology, and, you know, problems with compensation of executives, and particularly in finance. You can name all kinds of causes of inequality. But the way to address inequality, and the way to address, in my mind, the fundamental problems of you know, too much money in politics, is to vote for the politicians that want to move things in the right direction. So, I mean, there is one political party who is consistently supported the things that will promote growth, not just for the upper 1%, but for everybody. Things like universal health care insurance, universal high-quality preschool, more progressive income tax system, high wages, spending on infrastructure. And there's one party that's consistently opposed all those measures. And those measures have the ability to reduce inequality by quite a bit, regardless of where the inequality came from. Some of those measures have been enacted. We've gotten part of the way towards health care insurance for everybody through Obamacare. And the Republicans want to reverse that. And, you know, that includes Trump just as much as his predecessors. And it's the same thing on the income tax system and whether wages are too high or too low. Trump said they're too high in the first debate, and so on. So if you want to change the system, you know, show up and vote. Because like in the Brexit in England, it's actually the voter turnout that makes all the difference. If the young people turn out to vote, that completely changes the answer.
Yeah, but arguably, Jeff, when you look at Obamacare, just to play devil's advocate, I mean, we've got carriers dropping out of the system, and rate increases are 50 to 60%. I mean, that's obviously been an abject failure by the way it was set up, and it's just not working. So doesn't something have to happen there to fix that?
Well, I haven't heard any proposals from Trump or the Republicans on what would actually fix it. But no, at first
I haven't
all,
heard any proposals
success.
From anybody.
Last year, the number of uninsured people was at a record low, so it has been a success. Now, there are these problems you're talking about, and those problems are directly traceable to the actions of people who are trying to undo Obamacare. So, you know, many state governors decided not to take federal money, not to allow their citizens to be eligible to go on to Medicaid, and the states that opposed it, many, you know, red states, for the most part, with some exceptions, decided not to set up exchanges at their states. The system was supposed to be the exchanges were set up at the state level. For those states who refused, then the federal government was forced to step in. So, I mean, that's something you just don't see, that those problems, and we could discuss them, like the insurance companies dropping out. Those were exactly the problems that the system was that they tried to design Obamacare, just like Mitt Romney did here in my home state of Massachusetts, to address those problems, and they couldn't get all the way there. What we need to do is shift the incentives a little bit more, so that everybody, including healthy people, join the pools. And that would happen if people wanted to make the system work. It's the people trying to prevent the system from working that are leading to the partial failures. And I really say partial because the statistics show that Obamacare has succeeded in greatly raising the number of people who are covered by insurance.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I would love to have you back to debate the health care. I've got the health care issue. I've got a couple other things I would love to talk about, but we're out of time. And I love the perspective you brought, and I look forward to having you back on the program, Jeff.
Happy to do it.
Well, and as this segment draws to a close, let me once again take a moment to thank our special guest expert today, Jeff Frankel. We love to get a wide perspective of ideas here and positions on the Everything Financial Radio program. So thanks again to Jeff for joining us on today's program. Quick reminder, if you'd like to get more information about our Social Security maximization events coming up in Grand Rapids, one on Thursday, October 13, one on Tuesday, October 18, just visit the website, socialsecurityradio.com. The website is socialsecurityradio.com. I'll be back after these words. You are listening to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Glad you decided to tune in today. In this segment, I will be chatting with the Amazon best-selling author, David Scranton, about his book, Return on Principle. I know you're going to enjoy that conversation, so stay tuned for that. If you would like to go back and listen to any of the interviews that I do here on the program with our guest experts, it's easy to go back and reference them and listen to them as many times as you'd like. Just visit the website, everythingfinancialradio.com, and all of the past interviews are posted there. Again, the website, everythingfinancialradio.com. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. David J. Scranton. David is the Amazon best-selling author of the book, Return on Principle, 7 Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad. He is also the host of the Income Generation Show, on Newsmax TV. And David, it's a pleasure to have you here on the Everything Financial Radio program. Welcome.
Hey, Dennis. Thanks for having me. It's great.
David, let's start with your book, Return on Principle. What motivated you to write the book?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story because I was writing a financial book that I've later come to call, you know, the outside game of investing, the external game, where it was a how-to book, you know, when to buy, when to sell, how you should be allocated with your assets based upon having a certain goal or how you might want to be allocated differently if you have a different goal. And we got almost all the way through the manuscript, and I just wasn't feeling it for whatever reason. I just felt like it wasn't what people really needed. And as an aside, in interviewing millionaires, even billionaires on the television show, I was starting to draw conclusions that the difference between successful investors and unsuccessful investors, as well as the difference between successful advisors and unsuccessful advisors, was less about the external game, was less about the algorithms, when to buy, when to sell, and so on, but it was more about the mindset, the internal game. That these successful people and successful advisors had the right mindset. They possessed certain core values that allowed them to be really, really good as an investor or as an advisor. So we actually took the first manuscript, we put it through the shredder, literally put it through the shredder, and started rewriting from scratch. And the interesting thing is you never know when you're writing a book initially, and it's going to get published a year later, you never know whether the topic that's so important and so hot today is going to be a hot topic a year from now on your pub date. But as you mentioned before at the introduction, as it turned out, we were very fortunate because we became a bestseller with Amazon literally within 2 days. So clearly that tells me that what I thought was big and important for people to read and learn truly was on the money.
Well, let's explore that idea, David, of an internal mindset, and that to you is the big differentiator, to use that term, between those that are successful when investing and not investing. How do you measure mindset?
Well, it's difficult. What we've actually done in the book, because I wanted to make it tangible, you know, this, I was afraid when I made this decision to write the book about this, I was afraid that it was going to be in the psychology section of bookstores, and that's not really what I wanted. I want it to be a tangible book that people can use to increase their own sense of financial security. So we actually went ahead and developed questions, you know, for the do-it-yourselfer investor to ask him or herself to determine whether or not they possess each of the 7 core values. But then I also went ahead and utilized questions that they can use for their financial advisor. Because, you know, a lot of people assume, well, gosh, if this person is a financial advisor, then, heck, they must possess these 7 core values. But you know as well as I do with your years of experience that there are a lot of advisors out there that may have gotten into the financial advisory business for the wrong reason. You know, they don't possess the seven core values. They don't love investing. You know, just like doctors, a lot of people become doctors because of the money, not because they truly love helping people. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that a lot of financial advisors do that also. So these questions are designed for the reader to be able to go back to their advisor, ask them these hard questions, and really get a feel for whether or not the advisor possesses the internal game to truly do the best job with that person's money.
Well, I think that that obviously makes the next logical question for me to ask you is, what are some of these questions? Let's explore some of these.
Well, I'll give you a flavor. Again, I want people to buy the book, so I can't give away all my secrets.
Well, of course, and the book is available at Amazon. I'll get that plug in for you.
But for example, you know, one of the things is to ask advisors, what did you do to change your business model in the year 2000 or after 2000 when the technology bubble burst? And then to follow up and say, what did you do to change your business model in 2008 during the financial crisis? Because what amazes me, and I think this probably amazes you also, is the unbelievable ability for people to bury their heads in the sand, even when faced with a preponderance of evidence that maybe a change needs to occur in their business model. And that shouldn't surprise anyone. If you think about it, orthopedic surgeons almost never become chiropractors, and chiropractors almost never become orthopedic surgeons. So in the same light, if you get a financial advisor that started off in the career as a stock market-based advisor, that person is likely to stay as a stock market-based advisor no matter what. And despite the fact that that person's clients most likely took two shellackings since the turn of the century 16 years ago, a lot of those advisors are still burying their heads in the sand when it comes to the truth about today's financial markets. So that's why those questions about, you know, how did you change your business model, Mr. Advisor, in light of these two periods, you know, will be very telling. And most of the time what people will get is they'll get kind of a stutter and a glazed over look. And then there might be a manufactured answer, but to me that stutter really tells the whole story.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Mr. David J. Scranton. He is the Amazon best-selling author of Return on Principle, Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad. He is also the host of the Income Generation show on Newsmax TV. And, David, you know, when I spent some time on the corporate side of the financial industry, and back in 2001, after the tech stock bubble burst, there were a lot of brokers, a lot of advisors giving advice to people saying, you know, you've got to stay in it for the long haul. You can't time the market. We're just going to keep going and do what we've always done. And based on what you're saying and based on some of my experiences, that may not be a very good answer.
Well, it's true. And I was always the annoying child, more so than most, that always asked why. I'll never forget the story, and a lot of your listeners could probably relate to this. They've had similar things happen. I remember being in the grocery store with my mom when I was a little boy, when I decided that at that moment I had to learn how babies were born. I had to know right then and there, and I wasn't going to give up. So, you know, my mom was totally embarrassed walking through the store, trying to ignore me, and I kept saying, "Mommy, Mommy, you have to tell me now. How are babies made? I don't know." And the same is true when it came to the financial advisory field. I was relentless in asking questions. And when most people get into the financial advisory field, I call it stockbroker school, even though there's no such thing as stockbroker school. They're taught to say certain things. You know, they're taught to say, well, over the long run, Mr. Client, the stock market outperforms everything else. Or they're taught to say, well, you know, the markets are completely random and unpredictable. Or my favorite, and I'm sure one that you've heard many times from people, is, you know, it's not about timing the market. It's about time in the market. So as that child who always asked why, I had to say, okay, why is it that all these financial professionals brand new are being taught the same thing? Is it really in the best interest of their clients, or is it in the best interest of these financial firms? And when I started to really study and do my analysis, what I realized was that financial firms simply can't charge commissions and fees if there's huge periods of time when people are out of the financial market sitting on the sidelines. So what's interesting is the financial industry, in many ways, has an axe to grind. They want investors, they want advisors to think that markets are random and completely unpredictable. Because, let's face it, if markets are predictable and everyone knew that, then there'd be huge periods of time when advisors would be taking all their clients out of the financial markets, sitting in cash. And that means that every several years, all the financial firms would stop billing fees, they'd all go bankrupt, and they'd all start over again. And that's why I believe that the financial industry has done your average investor a disservice, and they've certainly done us as financial advisors a disservice, because they've withheld information about how predictable and how repeatable certain market cycles actually can be.
Well, I'm looking at the clock, David, and we are going to have to leave it there for this segment. But the good news for the listeners is that David will be back, and we will be chatting with him in the next segment as well. We'll hope you'll stay with us. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. This is the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Before I get back to my conversation with David Scranton, author of the book Return on Principle, let me remind you, in case you're just joining us, of a couple of free resources we have coming up in the Grand Rapids area. We have a couple Social Security maximization events. One will be held on Thursday, October 13 at the Highlands Golf Club. The other will be held on Tuesday, October 18 at Noto's Old World Italian Restaurant in Grand Rapids. Both of the events begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. The meeting is free. Dinner is free. Consequently, they fill up fairly quickly. If you'd like to get more information or register while there's capacity, visit socialsecurityradio.com. You can register there, or there is more information posted there. Again, the website, socialsecurityradio.com. I have the pleasure of chatting today with David J. Scranton. David is the Amazon best-selling author of the book Return on Principle, Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad. He's also the host of the Income Generation Show, seen on Newsmax TV. And David, in the last segment, we talked about the fact that at stockbroker school, to use that term, even though there is no such thing, brokers are taught to say, you know, it's not timing the market, it's time in the market, and all those cliches we've all heard, and that the markets are not predictable. And yet, I'm often reminded when I have a conversation like this of what we talk about here on the program frequently, and that is that, you know, it's what Winston Churchill said. If you want to understand the future, you need to look deeply into the past. And a lot of these economic cycles and these financial cycles are repeatable, and they are, in my opinion, somewhat predictable. And I gather that you might share that view.
Absolutely. And it's really a core premise in the book. You know, it's interesting. I was interviewed by a local television reporter in Connecticut years ago. And the question that this person asked me, I thought was a really good question. She said, what is the thing in your career about which you're the most proud? And I really didn't have to think at all. I said, the thing that makes me the proudest is the fact that back in late 1990s, 98, 99, I knew from my studies of historical stock market cycles that we were about to go into a bear market cycle, and it was going to take a long, long time before things got better. And what I'm proud of is the fact that unlike most of my competitors, I had the courage to change my business model from being a stock market-based specialist to being somebody who specializes in more conservative, non-stock market income-generating alternatives. And it, again, is a core premise of the book. We talk about how people make the same mistakes over and over again. There's a reason history repeats itself, because we don't learn from our predecessors' mistakes and errors and so on. And in the financial industry, the mistake I'm referring to most commonly is letting greed take over. You know, every generation has to go through a period of having excess greed and pushing stock market valuations up to ridiculous highs, pushing price-to-earnings ratios, for example, up to ridiculous highs. And then because we have that period of greed and overinflation, then we have to have the corresponding period of fear and stock market shrinkage. And these cycles occur over and over throughout history, and there are certain signals you can look at that, although they're not ironclad, they give you a decent indication of when the next cycle is ready to start. And for example, it's that information that allowed me to predict back in late 90s, 98, 99, that we're going into a long-term bear market. And also to write in my newsletter to clients, actually in October of 2007, that we're likely now to experience a second drop that could even be bigger than the first. And as you know, that second drop actually started the following month in November. And as our readers will see, it's also the reason why I really fear that we've got another significant drop in the not-too-distant future, one in the magnitude of 30 to 70%.
Well, David, I happen to agree with you. I mean, when you look just at the fundamental factors, look at price-earnings ratios, as you just mentioned, look at levels of margin debt, I would certainly be fearful that we're going to see something similar to that as well. So let me ask you, and getting back to the book, in the book you've got seven core values you discuss, and the subtitle of the book is Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad. Let's talk about some of these core values. Which would you say is the most important of the seven?
Wow, that's a great question. It's so hard to choose. The most important one is truly honesty, being brutally honest with yourself as to whether or not you have all the other core values, and therefore you have the inside game mastered when it comes to managing your own money. And that's hard. You know, people don't want to admit their own limitations sometimes. Financial advisors don't. In fact, a lot of financial advisors, after a long, successful career, will sometimes let egos get in the way and will cloud their judgment. You know, it's interesting because in the medical field, an internist, a primary care doctor, cannot do open heart surgery. He must refer you to a cardiac surgeon. But in the financial field, there is no such requirement. There is no Hippocratic Oath. The reality of it is an advisor could pretend that he's going to be all things to all people. And sometimes ego gets in the way, and they're unwilling to be brutally honest with themselves and their own limitations. And that's why we put questions in the book for people to interview that advisor to find out whether they're being brutally honest with themselves as to their strengths and weaknesses and whether or not they possess all the other core values.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting with Mr. Dave Scranton. Dave is the author of Return on Principle, Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad. You also talk in the book, Dave, about the core value of financial coachability. What do you mean by that?
Well, financial coachability is really the antithesis of stubbornness. And, you know, in America, we're a country of rugged individualists. You know, that's the pilgrims. That's how our country started, right? So it shouldn't surprise anyone that that's part of our internal makeup. And it's something that I think people need to fight. I'm actually a pilot, a commercially rated pilot. And one of the things that they drill into our heads when becoming a pilot is it's all about making the right decision. And the most important decision as a pilot is the go or no-go decision, especially as a business owner. You know, if I get through a long business day and I'm supposed to fly somewhere, but I know in my heart that I'm tired, it may be a little unsafe up in the air, you know, I've got to be able to be brutally honest with myself, and I have to look in the mirror and say, you know what, I've got to decide not to go. I've got to hold back and wait till the next day to make that flight. I can't be stubborn about it. And what amazes me is that a lot of people have certain beliefs about their money that they hold on to that they're just not willing to let go of, even when they have a preponderance of evidence that flies in the face of something they always believed when it came to their money or they held near and dear to their heart. And still, they don't want to let go of that, and they hold on to it stubbornly. And the great example is the stock market. You know, the stock market did great in the 80s and 90s, the best 20-year period we'd ever seen. But as you know, the market only experienced a 2 or 3% average growth rate over the last 16 years. But a lot of people are stubbornly holding on to that as if it's really were the only game in town, the only way to invest. And this is one area where advisors are worse sometimes than even investors, where they tend to hold on to whatever beliefs they had early on in their career and be unwilling to let go of them. And that shouldn't be any big surprise, because most financial advisors today got into the financial industry during the best stock market in U.S. history during the 80s and 90s. So their paradigm quickly became, gee, the more risk I can put my clients in, the more return I'm going to get. And even though they know in their hearts and they know on paper it hasn't worked so well over the last 16 years, they're simply not coachable enough to make that paradigm shift despite the preponderance of evidence to the contrary.
Dave, you might agree with this too. Don't you think that there's a lot of financial professionals out there that really have no knowledge of economic history? Because that's not something you really learn at stockbroker school, to use your term.
Well, that's right. And that's in part, you know, a couple of the other core values in the book are detail, orientation, and diligence. And I often talk about those together. You know, a lot of people get in the financial field and their clients automatically assume that they have this sense of diligence, sense of detail orientation to do all the work. And the reality is a lot of advisors are too busy marketing themselves, meeting with clients. So they're putting somebody in a mutual fund based upon a five-star rating, or they're buying a stock based upon some analyst's, you know, buy rating. Even think about the advisors that work for the big firms. You know, half the reason they go to the big firms is because they don't want to do their own research. They want to keep their lives simple. And unfortunately, most investors really never realize that the financial advisor's primary job is really to build the clientele, to get in front of new people, and to convince those people that they need to become a client. They're not sitting there exercising the detail orientation and diligence they really should. And that's why, to your point, absolutely, most advisors, it's astonishing to people, but most advisors really don't understand what you and I know to be true about the historical predictability and repeatability of these financial cycles.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been the Amazon best-selling author of the book Return on Principle, Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad, Mr. David Scranton. And Dave, it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Yeah, Dennis, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, that's about all the time we have for this week's program. Hope you got something you can use. If you're not yet a subscriber to the Portfolio Watch newsletter distributed by PLP Services, there's no reason not to be. It is free, and it is distributed every Monday at 5 p.m. It gives you our market and economic commentary every week, delivered to your email box. If you would like to subscribe to the free newsletter, just visit yourportfoliowatch.com. The website is yourportfoliowatch.com. Every week we track what's going on in the markets. We give you our take on what's going on economically and what it might mean for your money. The website, yourportfoliowatch.com.